Good evening. If you would be taking your Bibles and turning to the book of Esther. And for those of you who are visiting, this is really more of a Bible study than a worship service it is. So we will have some class comments, I hope. I certainly will ask some questions. Whether I get responses or not, that depends on you. Last week, Earl was assigned, I believe, Ezra 6 through Esther 6. And spoke on the temple, which I thought was an excellent lesson, but did not even touch Esther, which I'm fine with that. So, and then I'm supposed to cover Esther 7 or Esther 6, I can't remember what it was, through Job 20. Well, I talked to Gary, I don't know if I talked to Les, but I said, you know, that's kind of a hard task to cover those two books, and you're talking about two different time periods and all kinds of things. So I told Gary, I didn't tell Les, but I said, you guys can have Job. And I'll just take Esther, and I think it'll be more beneficial that way. And you know how precise and quick I am on my time, or you know, so it's going to be hard enough with Esther. If you gave me 20 chapters of Job, you'd really be in trouble right now. But and the thing about Job is you've got about 85-90% that is dialogue between the friends and Job, and I think Gary would have a hard time doing the middle of that anyway. So he can take the front of Job, and Les can take the end of Job, and we'll go from there. Well, let's talk about the book of Esther a little bit. Does anyone know what the most peculiar thing about the book of Esther is offhand? Vince?
God is not mentioned at all in the word of God.
That's it, exactly right. The name of God is not mentioned at all. And I find it interesting that this is a story about God's people and how the entire nation of Israel was spared from annihilation, yet there is not one single reference to him whatsoever. And that to me, that's a very interesting thing, that in this book, God is not mentioned. At this time in history, Israel has returned from the Babylonian captivity. And according to Ezra, about 42,000 have returned to Jerusalem and are attempting to rebuild the temple. But many of them are uncommitted. And the book of Esther, If you look chronologically, probably takes place between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra, chronologically speaking. So you've got 42,000 in Jerusalem, and the rest of the nation of Israel is dispersed throughout the eastern Mediterranean. They have no territory to return to. Why not? They lost it. They lost the land promise. God gave them the land, and they lost it because of disobedience and because of unbelief. So they have no territory. So they're dispersed, have been assimilated among all these provinces in the kingdom of the Medo-Persians. And they have lost the land, and they are no longer a great nation. Two promises to Abraham that were fulfilled, but now they have lost. One promise remains. What's that promise? The seed promise, that through the seed of Abraham, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And though Esther doesn't say that, that's precisely the promise I think Esther deals with. Because what happens in the book of Esther to the Jews? Or what is the threat? Complete annihilation of the Jewish race. And, you know, it's Haman's idea, but I don't think it came from Haman. You know, it's that he wants to completely annihilate the Jewish race. And if he were to do that, what would happen to the promise of the seed? It would be no longer. So the book of Esther, I think, is dealing with that seed promise being fulfilled. And, you know, we're near the end of Old Testament revelation in the book of Esther. We're just about 75 years from the 400-year period of silence between the Testaments. And God's name not being mentioned is interesting because he's already silent. He's not talking. And he's certainly not being honored throughout most of the nation of Israel. So there's no surprise that his name is not mentioned here. But just because he's silent, that does not mean he's not present. And that does not mean he is not active. And that does not mean he's not working behind the scenes and bringing about all these things to his purpose. And I think that's the beauty of the book of Esther, that we see God working through providence throughout this entire book. And it is just a beautiful story with a beautiful plot. And we're going to go ahead and try to review or try to go through the bulk of the book here. Incidentally, when we're talking about books that don't mention the name of God, what is the other book in the Bible that does not mention the name of God? Song of Solomon. Yeah, and we understand that. That's a whole but I think God is present in that book as well. But for a different reason, he's not mentioned, I think. Who are the four major characters in the book of Esther? One's pretty easy. Esther. I wanted to say that so I could know how to say his name. Ahasuerus. Mordecai. And Haman. Yeah, he's not a character we like, but he's one of the major. He's what you would call the protagonist if you've studied English literature. He's the enemy. He's the one who creates all the conflict. So he's the fourth one. So King Ahasuerus, who from now on is going to be called the king whenever I can, throws this big six-month party to show off all his stuff to his royal and military officials. 180-day party. Basically banquet, but a party. And then after that, he throws a week-long party for the capital city of Susa. And it turns out really to be a drinking party with an open bar. And basically, you can drink as much as you want. And that's really what we see there. You know, everybody could just drink as much as they wanted. Well, the king himself also does some drinking and gets completely inebriated. And while inebriated, when the best decisions are made, he decides he's going to have Esther come out and parade her before all these drunken men at this party. Vince. Vashti. I was just making sure you were paying attention. Thank you, Vince. Queen Vashti. Thank you. I'm sorry. Esther's not a queen yet. But he wants to parade Queen Vashti before all these drunken men to show off her beauty. How does she respond? She's not going to do it. I mean, this would be a completely humiliating experience for her, and I can understand why she would not want to do it. Well, the king is furious because she doesn't do this, and he's not only angry because she didn't do what he told her to, but she has in the present publicly disobeyed a command of the king. So he's infuriated. So still angry with Vashti, the king asked his counselors, the seven princes of Persia, according to the law, what's to be done with Queen Vashti, or Vashti, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name either. So Memucan, there's a good name for you too, one of the princes speaks up and states what he might turn into a potential problem. And what is the problem that he foresees from Vashti, or Vashti not coming and doing what the king bids? Earl? Yeah, you think Memucan may be worried about something at home. I mean, that you know, this is going to happen in my house if we don't straighten this up. So Memucan has this idea that the suggestion that Queen Vashti be ousted and the king find another queen, and an edict be issued that is written in the law that stating that she be ousted, and also that in all of the king's 127 provinces, from India to Ethiopia, I mean, this is a massive empire. I think I read somewhere that it was like, I don't remember numbers well, but I thought I read like 3 million square miles or something like that, that in all 127 provinces, that men should be masters in their own homes, and that you should speak the language of the husband or the father, and that this should be written in the laws of the Medes and the Persians. And incidentally, what is stated here about anything written in the laws of the Medes and the Persians? Once it is written, it cannot be repealed. So once it's written down in law, that's it. You can't do anything about it. Earl. That's a pretty dumb law. You know, it's like, you know, it's if you say something, you can't ever undo it. But that's what's written in the law. Well, you know, it's written. The problem is, a little while after this, the king remembers Vashti and he misses her. What's the problem? Can't have her back because she's been ousted by law. There's nothing he can do about it. So what suggestion then is made to the king? Yeah, and I think it's more than a beauty pageant, because it seems to me that basically what has been done is decided is that they're going to go out and they're going to get every beautiful young virgin and bring them back to the palace, put them in the king's harem for the king to pretty much pick from one of them. And we need to be careful to think of this as a beauty pageant. I mean, these are young virgins, probably in their mid to late teens, these women are, and this is not by choice. They are forcibly taken from their homes and brought into the king's palace. And, you know, I don't think this would have been considered an honor for this to happen. And I read some, I'm not sure if this is accurate, but I remember reading somewhere that once these girls were in the harem, they were in the harem for life. They could never go home because they were the king's property at that time. So this is not a beauty pageant. It is not this romantic thing that's going to be an honor bestowed of. And I don't think Les meant that. But this is some pretty serious business. And Esther, well, let's before I get into that, we'll talk about that in a minute. Any other comments before we move on?
This isn't something that these young women did on a volunteer basis.
No, they had no choice in the matter. Yeah, you have no choice in the matter. Can you imagine what an undertaking this was? If it is 3 million square miles, 127 provinces, do you know how much manpower this must have taken? I mean, you know, I have ambivalent feelings about King Ahasuerus. You know, he just seems so arrogant and selfish at times. But on the other hand, every once in a while, he seems kind of reasonable. And you know, kind of semi-decent. So it's but these are kings. These are despots. And you just see that the value of human life is just nothing. You know, we see that throughout this entire book and throughout the Old Testament. In those days and times, the value of human life was just, it was nothing to these kings and despots. Well, enter Mordecai and Esther onto the scene. What is their relationship? They're actually cousins. I always want to think of Esther as Mordecai's niece, but she is actually the daughter of his uncle, which would make them cousins. He must apparently be somewhat older, but he took Esther as his own daughter because her parents had died. We're not told how she died, they died, but he took Esther as his own daughter. And one gets the impression that she is his only child and that he has never been married. But I would think he's quite a bit older than Esther and certainly behaves as if she is his only daughter. And that's just a beautiful kind of intimate scene you see throughout the book of Esther. And Mordecai and Esther are of what nationality? Jewish. Yeah, they're Jewish. And they're living in the capital of Susa at this time. And I think there's pretty good reason to believe that Mordecai is actually a servant in the king's palace. And we'll see some more on that. But perhaps even a scribe, it has been suggested. Because he's got some knowledge and access and information that I don't think a normal citizen would have. And what does Mordecai instruct Esther regarding her people and her kindred when she is taken to be in the king's harem? Yeah, don't make it known. And is that something Mordecai hid? I don't think it's so much that he was worried about himself, because we see his actions later on. But he was worried about Esther and what that might do. And I just wonder if there was a strong anti-Jewish sentiment in the capital city of Susa and other places. I mean, there certainly was with Haman, you know, but perhaps that permeated the society to some extent. So he tells Esther, don't say anything about that. But Esther is this beautiful young woman, and she's taken along with all the other virgins. And as soon as she's taken, she finds favor in the eyes of Haggai, the servant in charge of these women, and he quickly provides her with cosmetics and food and gives her 7 maids and transfers her to the best place in the harem. Kind of reminds me of Joseph, because here's this woman who's taken against her will forcibly and in a bad situation, but something in her character, in her actions, in the way she conducts herself, she rises to the top. Of all these women, she rises to the top. And the chief servant over all of these women, you know, treats her very favorably. And we're told in Esther 2:11 that every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. This is a father whose daughter has been taken from him, it seems. And he just happened to be there in the capital, and I think in the king's palace. But when it comes Esther's time to be presented before the king, how does the king respond to her? Yeah, he loves her. Read verse 17 of chapter 2. We'll just pick out a few verses here and there. It says, "And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." And here's probably this girl in her teens, maybe late teens, I would think, being made queen over this, you know, very large, powerful province. You know, of course, a queen was more of a figurehead in those days and time, I think. But that's the position she is in. So after this happens, Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate, and he overhears a conversation between two of the guards. What does he hear? A plot against the king, exactly. So he informs Esther, probably not directly, and she tells the king, and she mentions Mordecai's name, and the plot is foiled, and the would-be assassins, Bigthan and Teresh, are executed, and all the information is written down in the book of the Chronicles of the king. Doesn't that become quite important later? That all this information is written down in the Chronicles of the king. Enter Haman. So Haman is one of the king's servants, and he gets promoted above all the other princes and really becomes second in command of the king, so much so that the king even gives a commandment that all are to bow down and pay homage to Haman. And one has to wonder how much that cost Haman to get that command written. Let's go ahead and look at Esther 3 and verse 2. And this is what makes me think that Mordecai is one of the king's servants as well. "And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so had the king commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage." And what reason does Mordecai give for not doing that? Or what reason are we given that he did not do that? It says in verse 4 that he had told them that he was a Jew. I think that's the closest we get to mentioning God in this book. He had told them that he was a Jew. Why would that prevent Haman from bowing down before Mordecai? Yeah, first commandment. Yes, you know, or and you know, yeah, "Thou shalt worship the Lord God, and him only shall you." Well, that's what Jesus said to Satan, but basically that's the first commandment. So Haman refused it. This is a man of integrity, and we see it the first time we see his character. And you know, here, this is the man who's second in command of the king, and Mordecai doesn't bow down to him. That's pretty impressive. He wasn't concerned about his own life, I don't think. He was concerned about Esther's life when he told her not to say anything. So he does not bow down before Haman. And Haman, being the mature individual he does, doesn't have a problem with that, right? Filled with rage about this. I mean, it infuriates him. He cannot let it go. And look what we're told in verse 6 of chapter 3. "But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus." It's not enough just to kill Mordecai. He decides he wants to kill all Jews everywhere. I mean, what an evil person this Haman is. And Esther calls him evil and wicked, I believe. When the time comes, we'll see that. So Haman hatches this plot in his mind. So he goes before the king, And basically says, hey, king, you know, there's this people, and they're kind of scattered throughout your kingdom. And, you know, they have their own set of laws, and they don't really obey your laws. And I think it's in your best interest to just get rid of them, to wipe them out. And oh, by the way, I have 10,000 talents of silver to help carry out this edict. 10,000 talents of silver. How many cubic feet is that, Zach? Zach told us how much all the it's all 750,000 pounds of silver. Haman says, I've got 10,000 pounds of silver to help you. What's he doing? He's bribing the king. He's saying, if you let me do this, I'll give you 10,000. That's really what's taking place here. I'll give you 10,000 talents of silver. And as I said, you know, here's what the king responds in verse 11 of chapter 3. And the king said to Haman, the silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please. And I think the king is saying, you give me the silver and you can do what you want to the people. I really think that's the point he's making. And again, we see this callous disregard for human life. It seems to me that's what's taking place here, unless you have a different idea of what's happened. It seems like Haman is paying the king in order for this to be filled out. So this edict to destroy all the Jews that Haman has come up with is issued as a law. And the king signs it into law. And what does that mean? It can't be changed. And I don't think we actually talked about what the edict was, but basically that all the Jews would be destroyed on a particular day and throughout all 127 provinces. So this edict is written and it's distributed throughout all 127 provinces. What does the king not know at this time? That Esther is a Jew, that he has just sealed the death warrant on his own queen. Haman has deceived him. And the thing is, he never even asked who the people are, at least not in the text. I find that amazing. That money must have sounded pretty good because he didn't even think about, of course, you know, if he had known it was the Jewish people and he had known Esther was a Jew, there might have been a different thing taking place. Of course, Haman probably never would have said anything in that case if he had known that as well. So Mordecai hears about all this. He's distraught. This becomes known to Esther, and she sends her servant to find out why is Mordecai out in the middle of the square, you know, in sackcloth and ashes, mourning publicly. So Mordecai informs Esther of what's going on, and he gives her a copy of the edict and tells her, you need to go before the king and implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Well, Esther initially resists. What is her reason for resisting? Yeah, you've got to be summoned to the king. If you go to the king without being summoned and he doesn't want you there, you're gone. And you've got to remember, this is probably a very young woman. And timidity would probably not be out of the... And she's thinking, you know, what happens if I do this? And then Mordecai has what probably is considered the key verse... or the key passage in the book of Esther, chapter 4, 13 and 14. Then Mordecai, when she objects, or initially is reluctant, then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. And really that, I think, is kind of the key verse to the book of Esther. One thing I wanted to say about this, and I've always found this peculiar, because Mordecai is almost saying two different things. He says, well, if you don't do this, God's going to take care of it anyway, but you need to do it. And one Hebrew scholar said that this can be translated as a question, which I really think makes more sense in the whole theme of the book, and it would be translated like this: for if you keep silent at such a time as this, will relief and deliverance arise for the Jews from another place? Indeed, you and your father's house will perish. Who knows, perhaps you have come to the royal office for such a time as this. And I think it may make more sense to see that as a question rather than two different statements. And there is, I've got an article from somebody who explains why it can be interpreted this way. So that's a possibility. But either way, the point Mordecai is making to Esther is that you may be in the position you're in for this particular reason. And I think when we read the book of Esther and see what takes place, that's exactly why she's in the position she's in and what takes place. I better move along here. So Esther ends up going before the king, and she finds favor in his sight, which doesn't surprise us because she found favor in his sight before. And he asks her what she wants. And she tells him right away what she wants, right? And this has always baffled me. She says, no. She says, can you and Haman come to a banquet I'm having for you today? And the king says, sure, we'll do that. And I'll tell you there. And he says, sure, we'll do that. And I think maybe it's just Esther being timid, or, you know, why would she even invite Haman? I don't know, but she does that. So Haman, let's see, where was I here? Oh, so they come to the banquet, and the king says, Esther, what can I do for you? Up to half my kingdom is yours. And she goes, come to a banquet tomorrow, you and Haman. And Haman's with him at the banquet, so the king doesn't press her, and they leave. And Haman's leaves, and he's feeling pretty good. I mean, he's just been in the presence of the king and the queen, been invited to a banquet, and now he's invited back tomorrow, and he's thinking, man, you know, I'm second in command of the king, and now the queen wants me in her presence. Things are going really well. I just love the way this plot develops here. Well, Haman's going home, and who does he encounter sitting at the king's gate on the way out? Mordecai. And what does Mordecai do? Doesn't do what he's supposed to. He doesn't bow down and pay homage to Haman. And Haman is furious. But it says he exercised control. But he's enraged. So he goes home pouting and whining and complaining about how everything would be perfect if it weren't for this stupid Mordecai. He didn't say that, but that's kind of the impression you get. And look, this just reveals so much about Haman. Esther 5 verses 10 through 13. Haman controlled himself, however, after Mordecai wouldn't bow down, went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which he had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. I don't think Haman knew how to count his blessings, did he? I mean, this man is richly blessed, but he's letting this one individual, Mordecai, spoil everything. He's the fly in Haman's ointment. Well, what does Haman's wife and his friend suggest that he do?
Build the gallows.
Build the gallows and hang Mordecai on it. And then you can go enjoy the banquet. And he's like, oh, what a great idea. I can kill this guy and then I can really enjoy myself. So he decides he's going to go first thing in the morning and get permission from the king to do this. And he could have Haman killed before the banquet and everything would be good. Couple things that we need to recognize here is when it says he wants to hang Mordecai, it's not hang like with a noose. It's hang like you would a pitcher and you impale it, or something you impale on the wall. And the gallows, the Hebrew word translated gallows here, is actually from the Hebrew word tree. So this is actually a tall stake, it appears, on which Mordecai was to be impaled. How they impaled them, I don't know. And that explains to me, you know, you think, how in the world overnight can you build a gallows 75 feet high? Well, part of that, maybe it was built on its rooftop, and if you count that. But if it's just a pole that's kind of secured, it would be a lot easier to do. And of course, Haman was a man of considerable wealth, so he had the resources to do whatever he wanted. But I think that explains a lot. This is not like you see in the Westerns where they got a platform and a noose and they're going to pull the cord you know, Haman's going to hang there by his neck. He's going to be impaled on this stake, on this tree, that for everyone in the city to see. And that's how Haman is going to get his satisfaction, by not only killing Mordecai, but killing him publicly so everybody can see what he's done. Exactly. And here's what's coming to you in, I think, 8 months or something after the edict was written, which is another strange thing we're not going to talk about, why that 8 month period, but I think that's the roll of the dice or the casting of the lots. All right. Where are we here? Well, that very night, the king can't sleep. And no wonder, the queen has asked him to come into her presence and tell him something, and twice she hasn't told him, and now he's got her coming back to another. And women haven't changed in how many years? The men are laughing anyway. So he can't sleep. So what happens? What's he call for? The Chronicles of the King to be read to him. I guess if anything's going to put you to the sleep, it's the Chronicles of the King is what he's thinking. So he calls for the Chronicles of the King, and what does the servant happen to read from the Chronicles of the King? Yeah, that Mordecai. Yeah, see, you were just testing me. I know. That Mordecai exposed the plot to kill the king. That's what he reads. And the king says, what's been done for Mordecai? And he says, nothing's been done for. So the king says, go out into the court and get the first guy you see and call him in here. Well, who happens to be walking into the court at that time? Haman. Just the way this develops is just beautiful. So the king calls Haman in and he says, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And what's Haman think? And he's thinking, who does the king want to honor more than me? So here's what we have. Here's what Haman thinks right here. Esther 6:6-9. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. And the king says, that's a great idea, Haman. I need you to do that for Mordecai the Jew. Can you imagine? Here, this man, he has just come to ask permission to execute. The king is saying, you need to go parade him through the city with my robe on my horse and say, thus is to be done for the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor. How ironic. I mean, this is what you call irony. I love the way all this unfolds. So Haman goes home and he tells his wife and friends what happened, and they said to him, Haman, if Mordecai is a Jew, you're finished. There's nothing you can do about this. Your fate is sealed. And just as they're speaking, the king's servants come to deliver Haman to Esther's banquet. And so they're at the banquet. Can you imagine what Haman is thinking at this time? The king and Esther and Haman. And the king asks Esther again what her request is, stating that he'll grant her whatever she wants up to half of his kingdom. A lot of kings were generous with half of their kingdoms, weren't they? We see that a bit in the Bible. But let's look over at chapter 7, verses 3 through 7. And this is really, you know, kind of part of the climax of what takes place here. Then Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. And can you imagine the king saying, what are you talking about, Esther? For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And you know, she is quoting the exact words from the law that Haman penned. And can you imagine what Haman is thinking at this time? Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. What a humble person she is. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And the king arises in anger and he goes outside apparently to cool off. Apparently he hadn't been drinking too much this time. So he goes out in the courtyard and in the garden, he's cooling off. And in the meantime, what's Haman doing? He's on his knees. Here's Esther on the couch, and he's on his knees before Esther, pleading for his life. And the king walks back in, and what's he thinks going on? Yeah, that he's assaulting her. He's making advances toward her. And he's like, who is this guy? And basically, and the servants cover his face, and they take him out. And then one of the servants says, hey, look, king, behold the gallows which Haman erected on which to hang Mordecai. And the king says, you hang him there. So on the very gallows that Haman had constructed to kill Mordecai, he himself is killed. I think there's a type there when you think about it. Because what is happening here, it seems to me, is Satan is attempting to destroy the Jewish people and destroy the promise of the seed by destroying Mordecai and all the Jews, and therefore there will be no Savior. And Haman is the one whom Satan is using to do that. Well, Haman himself is impaled on the very tree that he was going to impale Mordecai on. When we think of the cross, don't we see the same sort of thing? Satan, I believe, thinks the cross is going to be his final victory over Christ. He doesn't know God's purpose. He doesn't know, and he thinks this is it. This is the culmination of everything I've tried to do to destroy the Son of God. And he thinks he's going to win the battle there. And what happens there? Sin is nailed to the cross. And Christ is victorious. And sin is done away with. And I wonder if there's something to see here in that hanging of Haman on that cross that he erected to destroy the Jewish people. Or more to come.
You know, when Haman comes walking in the court, you know, by chance, that Haman's the one walking in the court, you know, at that particular time, and the king says, call him here. By chance, problems.
This whole book. I mean, God is on every page of this book. Mm-hmm. His name may not be mentioned, but he is present. He is working behind the scenes, making all of these things happen for his purpose. He has not forgotten his promise to Abraham and to the Jewish people that through Abraham's seed, the kingdoms of the earth shall be blessed. Well, the king now realizes the far-reaching consequences of what Haman has done by his edict to destroy the Jews. You know, and, well, I missed that part. I was going to say all this bloviating stuff, as they say, but let's go on and move on. But you know, Haman's plot was going to destroy the king's queen, is what he realizes. Look at Esther chapter 8, 1 through 2. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther, and Mordecai came before the king. For Esther had disclosed what he was to her, and the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So that's the end, and they all lived happily ever after, right? Now, there's still a problem that exists, and what's that problem? The Jews are still going to be annihilated. And so what's to be done? Esther goes before the king and says, hey, we need to take this law off the books. And the king says what? Can't do it. Once it's written in the laws of the Medes and Persians, it cannot be undone. So what takes place? What is the solution to this problem? That the Jews are still going to be completely annihilated if something doesn't happen. Another law has to be put into effect. And what is the other law? Yeah, the Jews are going to be granted the permission through the law to defend themselves against their enemy. Not that the law is destroyed, but that they are able to counteract the effects of the law. So a new law is written that allows the Jews to defend themselves from anyone who attacks them, which essentially takes away the destructive power of the first law. Anybody see a parallel there? The new covenant took away the power of the old covenant. And really, Jesus said, I did not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. And there is a sense in which, you know, we are still condemned by the law, aren't we? I mean, if there was a law that could have given life, certainly righteousness would have come by that law. But the scripture has concluded that we are all under sin, Romans says. But it's the new law that frees us from the power of the old law. And I think there's also a parallel here in the book of Esther. So the new edict is signed in the law, and instead of the Jews being annihilated on that day, they rid themselves of their enemy. Haman's descendants are destroyed, and all he had been given to Mordecai, including his place of authority as second in command of the king. And the tradition and festival of Purim is established, which memorializes these events for the nation of Israel. And really, you know, the book of Esther, on the surface, is about Purim and how that tradition developed. But beneath the surface, I think it's all about God working in the lives of men and women to fulfill his purpose. Our time is about over, but real quick, what are some practical lessons we can learn from the book of Esther? Any thoughts? He does. He fulfills his promises and takes care of his own. And even though he is not necessarily visible, that doesn't mean he isn't present. And that's a good lesson for us, isn't it? Because sometimes it may not seem like God is there. But what he promises us in his word is if we trust him and we serve him, he will be there. And, you know, what is it? Romans 8:32. I had a couple passages written down. That all things work together for good, or 8:28, to those who love God, to those who love him. Another lesson or two, he who exalts himself shall be humbled. Boy, Haman is the best lesson of that, isn't he? God is faithful to his word. I think that kind of goes hand in hand with what Joe is saying. That, you know, that he, when he says he's going to do something, he does it. And it seems to me that throughout the scriptures, we have Satan doing everything he can to thwart the purposes of God. But God is 10 moves ahead. Esther's already in the position as queen before Haman comes up with the plot to destroy the Jews. He's got her in place where he needs her already. So I think it's just beautiful the way that all works. God is in complete control. It's just, and that's one of the lessons I think we have from the book of Esther. Zach?
How's it? Because he had Haman plan and execute how Mordecai was honored, and then Haman was killed on the state that he
was. Yeah, well, and it's certainly irony, it's amazing. Any other thoughts? Oh, one other thing I wanted to say, and that's probably a good lesson in 1 minute here. Our circumstances may provide unique opportunities. Esther was where she was for the specific purpose that God had intended for her, to save the Jewish people. And who knows why we are where we are. And there may be opportunities that are afforded to us because of our position that would not be afforded because of anybody else. And maybe it's just one individual soul that we can have an influence over or an effect on because of our job or our relationship in school or whatever else it might be. So a lot of good lessons from the book. I love this book. It's one of my favorite books in the Bible. Of course, I say that about every book I study, I think. So thank you for your time.